Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
You've reached the Murder Between Friends podcast with Sherilyn Dale and Gavin Fish. Please stay on the line. This week's episode starts in 3, 2, 1.
Hi, Danielle.
Okay, so...
Hi.
Thank you for coming on here, hey?
Thank you for having me.
Maybe where we should start here...
I have a lot of questions. So Gavin, you spearhead where we're going to start, and I'm sure I'm going to have some like as we go.
Okay. So for people who are watching / listening, this is Danielle Winkowski. I've known Danielle for a couple of years now. I mean, it's been a minute, hasn't it, Danielle?
Yeah. I feel like it's been longer than a couple of years.
Yeah, maybe it has. I don't know. But Danielle's sister, Amanda, is the victim of a horrible crime. You can go to my channel and you can see all about it, but let's
That's
see,
actually
I'm going to rush through Danielle.
I do want you to rush through it, Gavin, but I did kind of have that note that I wanted to talk about is I obviously want everybody to watch this episode like right now, but if they're not familiar with Amanda's case, you have very easily digestible episodes. They're quick to listen to, give a lot of information, you know, a lot of information quick. And you did 4 parts, right? 4 or 5?
Oh, I did like 98 parts. There's so many. I think there are nine.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, but you have a file of it, right? Like on your.
Yep.
Wasn't there like eight episodes or nine episodes?
Okay, perfect.
I think there are nine episodes.
Yeah. So after this, listening to this or before, however the audience wants to do it, go to Gavin's site. It is so well done. It's like a documentary, Gavin. You did such a good job with this.
Well,
you do with
thanks
everything.
Thanks for the rah-rah. But listen, I want to rah-rah Danielle here a little bit. She's going to be a little bit embarrassed. But one of the things that I really love about Danielle from the first time we first met, the first time we met was I went up to Buffalo, New York for a rally at her mom's house. And while the rally was happening, Danielle and I and an unnamed third party were kind of standing in the background chatting. Her sister, Amanda, and Danielle were kind of in the same boat. Do you think that's fair to say, Danielle, as far as what your life experience was at the time leading up to what happened to Amanda?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, as I was standing there talking with Danielle, I was like, dang it, had Amanda been given the opportunity, she would have come out of it the same way Danielle did. And I'm sitting, I think I might be like 10 years older than you guys, but I had like this swelling of like paternal pride. Like, look at this woman. She's rad. She's come through. She's overcome. And that's why I love Danielle. She's awesome. So I'll stop embarrassing you. Very quickly, Amanda Winkowski was 20 years old. She was in a temporary living situation between the time her family moved away from the town she was living in to the time that her sister, her other sister, was going to move into town and they were going to room. Amanda didn't want to leave town because she was starting college. And so for just a temporary time, she moved in with I'm going to use air quotes here, a family friend, a guy named Adam Patterson. Adam was not a friend, but the family had known him a long time. He proved not to be a friend. But in those couple of weeks that Amanda was living with Adam, she disappeared. And it turns out that he was the last person to ever see her. And then 7 weeks later, her body was found thrown away into a garbage can in the Buffalo winter. She was completely frozen solid. She was naked when she was found. She was upside down in this garbage can, which was placed in kind of an alcove of a church. Like the building was built so that there was like this little space in between wings of the church. Mm-hmm. But that little alcove was directly across the street from the house of the last place that anybody saw Amanda Wynkowski alive.
Yeah.
It was the home of Antoine Garner.
Right. And
that is what happened to Amanda.
And from there, so I loved the way that you opened that in your episode where everyone goes, okay, like, so we kind of are getting the picture here. So she was murdered. And then you go, and her death was ruled an overdose.
Correct. Yes. So that's, I guess that's us setting the stage, Danielle, a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. What questions do you have, Sherilyn?
Oh, gosh, like so many.
I just put you on the spot.
You're like, okay, okay. And you know me, like, I'll go like for days here. So, I guess first of all, like, I'm going into terms of just like the lifestyle because I have very close family. I'm not sure if they'll, I should ask if they're, you know, in a later episode, if they're comfortable for me saying who it is. Cause I think that then it's just even more relatable, but a very close family member of mine, was an addict. I think she's like 15 years clean this year. And so through that, her journey of getting sober, I was in like AA meetings often, CA meetings often. So I've been able to see that side of things and how misconstrued people who have never experienced that or never known somebody to be addicted to something can take something. And I think that that's really a big part of like Amanda's case, right? In terms of how the investigation went and stuff like that. So I guess like I just want to know what that's like for you to want to fight and show more of who Amanda was. Like when her boyfriend was on Gavin's podcast talking, she sounded like somebody who was like fiercely loyal, who would do anything for other people, include put herself at risk. So I really want people to hear about like who Amanda was, like aside from, you know, getting caught up in something that truly just takes over your life and you have no control over. Like she was so much more than that. So I want to hear, you know, another story of fiercely loyal Amanda. There's so much more to a person behind their addiction, right? Like an addiction is that's not who they are, were, or what they should be defined as, and not an excuse to not, you know, to just like toss away an investigation. So when people get to know who that victim is, it makes them fight so much more because you know, right? Like you're like, that is not who my sister was. This is who Amanda was.
Thank you. Thank you. So thank you. So it's something that I have dealt with this whole entire investigation is the stigma. And I think the stigma on addicts and how, you know, they chose their lifestyle. So this is where, you know, what they put themselves at risk. But what they don't understand is first off nowadays, if you don't know someone or have a loved one that has dealt with addiction, then either they're very closed off or there's very select few because, or it's, you know, the black sheep of the family and they don't want to open up about it. And, you know, but it can be from people that are born in poverty to people that are rich and have tons of money with a silver spoon in their mouth. You know, it doesn't define who the person is. And honestly, Amanda was closer to sobriety, I feel like, than I was back then. Like I don't want to say everyone, but a big part of addiction, you go back and forth with it. Like it's for a lot of people, it doesn't stick the first time. It's very hard. It grabs you. It like steals your soul. That's a whole nother ball game, but you to feel well is all you want to feel. And right. It nothing else matters. So even putting herself at risk, because that was my biggest thing about the east side of Buffalo. Like Amanda knows better. Like we know better living in this area. That's like the place you don't visit. That's the place, especially being a young white girl, like or even pretty girl. Like, I mean, you just don't put yourself in that situation, especially with what we were up to at that point. We were, you know, with our addiction. So, it just wasn't who she was, but she was Adam, I think, is the biggest part of this, was because she trusted him. She didn't think that he would ever, like, yes, she went into this house, but she probably thought never in a million years would he just leave. You know what I mean? Right. If something were to go wrong, why wouldn't you call the cops?
What was the relationship that Adam had with your family? How did you guys know Adam Patterson?
So, my stepfather, he's no longer married to my mother, but he was for 15 years. He's actually my two youngest sister's father. He grew up with him. He went to high school with him. They went to the service together. And so he knew them. Like, and it wasn't somebody that we all knew, but it was our stepfather. And we had moved out to Wheatfield, and we were living out here for a few years, and he had come over all the time. Like, we've seen him, you know, with our stepfather. And that was kind of the gist of the, like, no one was close to him besides John, but I mean, it was our family. So that was kind of how Amanda, and I guess she saw him out one night, and they kind of created a friendship. And she was 19, 20 now, so she was able to have adult relationships. She bartended. So
people probably need to understand as far as the area. So yeah, tell us about, I guess, the area. What was happening at the time?
The area. So my mom had, she actually, that stepfather, she actually had split up with him, and she was in a new relationship, and she moved. So they moved out of the house they were living in, and she was moving in with her then boyfriend, and he lived out, it was like Eden or something, somewhere far. And, until they moved into their new house that they got together. And that's why Amanda didn't want to go out to Eden with them. I might be saying the wrong place, but it was far. Yeah. It was like somewhere like Eden. Let's say Eden. But they weren't there long. They were only there like a month or so, but it was during a breakup and a new relationship. And, you know, the older kids were like, well, I don't want to go move out there. I want to stay here and that type of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was that does happen, right? Like when you've got little ones, and it's not like a different family dynamic, but it kind of is. It's like, okay, like you've got like the stepdad and the mom with like the new little nuggets, and they're kind of redoing that from scratch. And like, that's very similar to my upbringing, because I had a sibling who came a year after my oldest daughter. So it was like, I was already like doing my own thing. And so Amanda wanted to stay, and she was older. I mean, that's not unreasonable request.
And she had plans. My oldest sister had lived in Vegas, and she was moving back, and they were getting a place together. So that was the whole, like, she knew Carolee was coming back within the next couple months, and they were going to get a place together. And that was her next move. So she was like, I only need, you know what I mean, a few weeks to a month, and I'll be moving in with Carolee. So her job was out here, school was out here. So she just didn't want to move an hour away and uproot everything she had going on, especially with everything that had gone on. She had come a long way when it comes to getting her sobriety under control. She before that, she couldn't hold a job. She had all her schoolwork in place. She had, you know, she had figured out the Suboxone clinic, which at that point back then was a very hard feat. Like, it wasn't like as simple as like going to, addiction specialist now and being like, I need Suboxone or I need methadone or whatever the case may be. Back then, like there was doctors getting arrested left and right for illegally prescribing them. You had to like jump through hoops. It was oh yeah, you can get Suboxone, but it'll take you 8 weeks to get it. So like in the meantime, people that were on addicted, they couldn't just wait 8 weeks. They would end up back out on the street. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Much easier said than done.
I mean, especially back then. And I don't think people realize the difference like nowadays to back then. Right. Like it was a very hard feat to get a Suboxone doctor enroll and like get it all going. Like it was a hard thing to do.
Right.
Well, and when we're talking back then, just to kind of set the time frame, Amanda went missing in December of 2008 and her body was found in January of 2009. So we're talking, I can't do the math, 13, 14 years ago, right? Almost.
Yeah.
Right.
Holy cow, Danielle, in 5 days, that will be the anniversary of Amanda going missing. December 8th, right?
Mm-hmm.
December 5th is when she went missing.
5th, yeah.
December 5th.
So 2 days. Monday. 2 days, yeah.
Yeah.
So when this episode airs, it'll have already gone. That was one of my questions. How are you guys doing?
This is a hard time of year for Leslie.
It really is. She kind of, you can already see it like on her social media. Like she never stops posting, but like she gets back into like, I think it just brings her. I was just talking about it yesterday about her and like how she really has come a long way. I really want to give her that much, but for such a long time, it completely changed the person she was. Like it really did. And I don't think she'll ever be the same, but this time of year is exceptionally hard for her. Cause like, I think she just relives every moment of it. You know what I mean? Like she just, and I think it gets in her head too, that there's still, that's that her biggest thing is to get justice and she's still not there.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is maybe more important for those of us. Well, my mind is going faster than my mouth is able to do. Within the true crime community, Sherilyn and I have talked about this a lot. It does feel like people are just after horrific stories a lot of times. They just want to be horrified by terrible stories. But you and Leslie and the rest of your giant family, I mean, this is a big family. You have to live with this. And now we're coming up on 14 years. How are some of the ways that, right? Isn't that like 2008?
Yeah, I was like, has it been that 2008 to 2023? It would be 13, 14, 15, 15, 14?
Oh, yeah. 14 years.
2009, yeah.
Yeah.
So like, what has changed, for example, in your mom? What's the difference between who she was prior to this versus who she is now?
Well, I do want to say, like I said, she has come a long way, but for a long time, she eats, sleep, and like breathe for all day long. It was Amanda. Whether she literally would have a phone attached to her, like that's besides the point. But I mean, I can't imagine the stress. Like she literally was making calls to lawyers and this person and that person and whoever it may be. I mean, that phone was never off. And I'm like, you need to eat. Like you need to sleep. You need to till 4 o'clock in the morning, every night talking to people about what to do next and who so-and-so. And she still, to this day, has people reaching out to her on a regular basis, whether it be people that were in prison or people that had, and I cannot imagine as a mother, because I mean, as a sister, but as a mother to have to deal like, and then you have to like kind of talk her off a ledge on some of this stuff too. Cause it's like, okay, like, yes, absolutely. Some of it, I absolutely believe, but then some of it, I don't know if people, there's so many plausible scenarios of who was there and who did what, but what it boils down to is Antoine and Amanda. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
But there's for so many years, you know how it went, like the cops or the investigator, he wasn't credible or he can't tell us that happened or just things that in any normal day scenario should be fine. And they would say that it wasn't good enough or it wasn't okay. You know what I mean? I mean, even stuff that we've done, like they don't call us back. They act like it's not a big deal when in any other scenario, that person should be in prison and charged with her murder. And it should have never been an accidental overdose to begin with. Right. Just like the whole thing. Well, I don't know. I'm going to talk in circles now. So
no, but it's absolutely true. This is the first case in a chain of several that I've looked into that where something horrible happened. And then for reasons that are unknown to me, that can't be explained with any level of rationality or logic, they just kind of sweep it under the rug. It's like a second victimization, right?
So 100%, yeah.
The very first thing I ever heard about Amanda Winkowski was, oh, she's an addict, she was a prostitute. It was like just immediately, just in order to maybe marginalize her a little more, make me not care about her, or make me care about her less so that I won't work as hard. And that
which
just
is ridiculous. And we've had this conversation. Oh, and okay, my blood just started boiling. Because this is what's so ridiculous is that I don't even know where to start, but it is conversations like this. It's having people listen who have no idea what that lifestyle is like, having no, either not being in it, not knowing somebody from it. Even if somebody came up to you and said, oh yeah, Amanda was a sex worker and she was an addict, what does that matter? She is a human. If that was mm-hmm. true, it doesn't change somebody's deservingness of justice.
Yeah, their value, right? Their value.
Their value. Thank you, Gavin. Exactly. Yeah. Like I, and that it makes me so mad when I hear things like that, or when somebody, a victim is defined like that, in any story. And I guess that it is important to a story if you're trying to lay down a foundation. So I think that it's the responsibility of people who are digesting this type of content or who are reporting about it and talking about it is to take that minute to explain that it doesn't define somebody. And if that was their lifestyle, that was their lifestyle.
Did Gavin ever explain to you though that like Amanda didn't have a past of that? Like,
right. Yes.
Yes, we know things at this point, but like someone else shared that. Like it was right. Like they brought that into the picture.
They tried to.
They made it part of the story when, yes, there is parts of the story that need to be told, but like it wasn't like she had an arrest or she had any known.
There's no even criminal from record. Us,
yeah. Right. Like we learned about it through, and it wasn't, I don't even want to say. That's exactly it. There's no criminal record. There was no nothing. Like, and basically the media told us that even something existed in the first place. And then
there was more to the story. That through the media?
Yeah. Like we didn't share that. And then I learned while she was missing. I think I've told you this before between Polly and all the situation, but basically I was like, why didn't you tell me? And he was like, well, she would have killed me. Like, it was that new. It was, like, within a few weeks. Like, we had no idea until she was missing that something like that was even going on.
Actually, that is a good segue into my next maybe comment/question, Danielle. Just the other day, I was standing in, like, a city hall in a little town out here in PA talking to the chief of police of that town. And we were talking about, you know, the different drug epidemics that have happened in that town over the 30 years that he had been policing there. And, you know, he was describing what you were describing before, like when the economy was gangbusters out here in Western Pennsylvania because of the oil industry and everything, then he was always dealing with cocaine. And then when the economy tanked, the oil companies moved to Texas and stuff like that, then it became heroin, it became methamphetamines and stuff like that, right? But one of the things he brought up was that no matter what was happening what he said was that when heroin hit town, the people who were addicted to heroin, it was a very different addiction because they weren't chasing a high. They were simply trying not to be sick. Like once they had gotten addicted, which took once, right? then they start to come down from that. They're getting sick. So now they're chasing, trying to feel well, right? And then the decisions that they make are based on that. What am I going to be able to do to be able to get heroin so that I'm not sick right now? And that leads to, you know, robberies, and that leads to lots of other criminal enterprises, right? But exactly. Can you describe, I mean, you and Amanda were kind of in this boat together at the time. Can you describe what that experience is so that maybe we can understand what was driving Amanda to make the decisions she was making?
Yeah. I mean, first off, think of, you know, all your morals and all of anything that you ever thought that you would never do. First off, you would never do heroin. Like, okay, I'm going to try this drug, but I'm never going to do those hard ones. Like, I'll drink and smoke weed. I think all young teenagers or young adults that go into that, to making those choices, you know, they always promise themselves, okay, we'll try this one, but we're not going to go to that one. Like, we'll never do that. And then secondly, think about everyone that you've ever loved and how bad you're hurting them. And at this point, they know. When it gets to that point where you are stealing from your loved ones, from stores, risking getting arrested, like whatever it is to make it so you can get that fixed, that's why they say like, oh, you sell your soul to the devil. But you literally feel like that. You don't even feel like yourself anymore. You literally feel like you're not even you anymore because you've gone against all your morals, everything you've ever promised yourself. And like, even though you might not think about this stuff on a daily basis, when you're in active addiction, you do, because you broke every promise you've ever made to yourself, and you do it to yourself on a daily basis, let alone your loved ones. Nothing else matters. And as sad as that sounds, like you just want to feel well, and you keep promising yourself, like, this is the last time, like next week, you know, tomorrow or next week, or once this money's gone or whatever the case may be, like, I'm not doing it ever again. And then you're really all into it when you're okay. When you have your stuff and you're okay, you're like, all right, I'm done. I'm never doing it again. But as soon as that starts to creep in, even when you don't physically have stuff anymore or money, you can already physically start to get sick. It's so insane. Like, your mind is a crazy thing because you physically know what's coming. So like, you're like, oh my gosh, like I need more now so I don't get to that point again. It's just it's been a long time since I've
felt like that. It's like a fight or flight, right? Like, it's like a fight or flight. You know, nobody wants to feel uncomfortable. Nobody wants to feel like, what, like, no different than being sick, you know? Like, we treat that. We want to feel better. We do everything that we can.
But it's – I can't even explain it to a sickness because, like, I've had 12 years. October, I had 12 years sober.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And even now, thinking about it, like, I can get anxious. I could get anxious thinking and talking about it. And I don't feel like that anymore. Like every day, every year, every month, like that's gone by, I've been fine, but I can feel myself like talking about it. Like you can relive that. Like it is, it's a fight or flight. It's a trauma like that. I can't imagine ever going back to, but it's just, it's so much worse than some illness. Like I don't want to anyone to ever compare it to the flu. Yes, you get cold sweats and diarrhea and shaking.
Shaking
skin. Yeah. You're literally not comfortable in your own skin. It's so much more than just
fight or flight. You're trying to stay alive. Like I do not want to go there.
Like you feel like you're going to die. And like, I know that might be, but it's bad. And it only people that have experienced it can understand it. Like it's just awful.
Right.
So Amanda's in the middle of this.
Yeah, exactly. So Amanda was, that's exactly it. It'll make you do things, like you said, I'll never do this. And then, you know, like once that one, you know, that one threshold has kind of been crossed, there's like a little bit more leeway to cross the next one, right? Okay, well, I might be able to do it this way or go over here and I'm feeling a little bit more comfortable. And for her, you know, it also plays into people that you're hanging around with and that she's trusting. So she's probably in that moment talking herself through, it's okay because, you know,
like I said,
Adam's here, right?
Yeah.
What is the theory here? Like, what was there the connection between Adam and Antoine? What is this? Because there was a past where somebody had also brought someone to Antoine, correct? Who survived. But it sounds like that's what Amanda had gone through.
Oh, yeah. Go you're ahead, talking Adam. About Celeste.
But it yeah. wasn't oh, Adam oh. who brought.
No, it was one of her friends.
Maybe we talk about Antoine Garner here a little bit, okay?
Yeah,
Antoine like Garner to, yeah. lived on the east side of Buffalo. That kid, like, I hate to use the word in fairness to him, but in fairness to him, he never had a shot. That guy was born into the hardest, most abusive place. It makes me like thank my lucky stars that I won somehow the lottery of loving parents, right? But Antoine yeah. Garner, either because of who he was or how he was raised, was really a monster of a human being, a terrible human being. He had attacked sexually multiple women from the time he was in high school.
Yeah, in high school. He did it in the school.
16 years old.
And as like a 14, 15-year-old boy. Yeah, he was young and he was already giant, right? He was, what was he, six foot five? I think he eventually became, yeah, 350 pounds. The dude is huge, right? And he was from the time he was a little kid. So he would throw around his weight, like literally and figuratively, and he would attack these women. And there is another woman. Her name is Celeste. She has gone on the record. She's been happy to share her story, who was taken by one of her friends to Antoine Garner in what appears to be a setup, like Antoine got him to bring her to him, after which she says he raped her and tried to kill her, and she was able to talk her way out of it.
Wow.
She was... I mean, man, talk about like, I don't know, like in the most difficult, darkest place that you can possibly be. And she had the mental fortitude to manipulate him well enough to be able to leave. It was amazing. Yeah. But what did she say to police? Is like, she reported this. What did she say to them? She goes, he's going to do it again.
Yes.
And someone's going to die.
Right.
And that was like, what, and a month?
A month and a half before Amanda.
Oh, yes. My gosh. Yes. Like, it's infuriating.
Yep. October was Celeste, and Amanda was December 5th.
So what was the deal there, Gavin? Why was he never, like, why was he on the streets?
And that, well, go ahead, Gavin, you answer.
I'd love to hear what you think, Danielle.
I think that it's connections. There's no way. I mean, he literally pulled a gun on a cop at 16 and they got rid of that charge. They got rid of the charges of him attacking the girl and I don't even know if we're allowed to share this stuff, but him attacking the girl in high school in the locker room.
No, we can. It's,
oh, yeah,
it's
you are. Yeah.
Yeah, it's out there.
So, yeah, it's okay. I mean, he's had charges that just... How do you get that stuff to go away? You pull a gun on a cop and that you're out to just freely go do what you please. You attack girls in your locker room and that just goes away. And I mean, I understand he was a kid at the time, but I don't understand how that stuff goes away. Then there was Celeste. Wasn't there another one?
Tom.
Yeah.
Do you remember
him? Well, that he ended up going to jail for robbing his house too, though. But Tom, he had so many charges.
Well, yeah, but like, he was sexually abusing men and women. Antoine was.
Yeah.
So like, in the case of Celeste, I think what Danielle said is correct. He does have some connection to a politically powerful family in Buffalo. And number two, Celeste, with all of her like hero level decisions and actions, did not want to go to the hospital. She did not do an examination, like a post-rape examination. But again, Celeste comes from the wrong side of town. Celeste is
I was
an
just
addict.
Gonna say, was this circumstantial again? Like, is it the police go, okay, well, you know, mess with the bull, get your horns. Yes. Oh my gosh. Like, it's absolutely infuriating. Like, he should have never been out.
Exactly. He was even arrested for harassing and like menacing my mom. I don't even know, like kind of some kind of stuff with her. the burglary, even the rape that he went away for, like that stuff was old and like got pulled back in. And they were like trying to say, well, at least he's in jail for something. Like that's what they were trying to tell my mom. Yeah. Well, they tried to, or at least she's in jail for something.
Oh my God. And so he is in, I think, like let's let everybody know if they're not familiar for the with the case. He is in jail now.
He's in a maximum security prison right now.
Yeah, but not
And he gets out this year, doesn't he? 2023?
I think 2023 is when his minimum sentence is. So depending on his behavior. And then he has
to appeal that, right? Yeah, exactly. Which is terrifying, though, because look at what he's already gotten away with. I mean, that's another thing to consider here.
Even his brother in prison, because we do have people that we've talked to and we've through family, even friends, but like people that have become like that have talked to us that were in prison with his cousins or even Antoine, like cellmates, like things. And even his brother and his family, there's a lot of them that aren't they're familiar with the criminal side and prison. And none of them are, I don't want to say none of them, but there's a few of them that are very, they know what they're, I don't even know what I'm trying to say, but they all have visited prison and they're criminals or whatever the case. Right. And even they said that like Antoine, he's their brother. So, cause he's like one of eight kids as well. But like basically that like he's the black sheep of the family, but they have to have his back because, but the things he does, like they are unforgivable. Like they don't even want to stand behind him anymore, basically.
Right.
Through the grapevine, but like through people in prison, but like basically they don't even want to stand behind him anymore because of the monstrous things he's done and like what they know he's, you know, been charged with. Capable of. So.
Right. So, and so what was that? What was that case that finally, that he's now in prison for? What
combined,
was the circumstances there?
They combined the burglary charges, which Tom is a big part of Amanda's case as well. They combined, he robbed his house. His dad was a doctor. He robbed the house. And so he got charged with burglary. And then there was another rape charge for another girl.
It was a statutory rape. 19-year-old, if I'm getting this, I'm probably getting the details wrong on this, but like a 19-year-old came in to like file a paternity kind of like he's not supporting his child. Well, the child was like 3 years old, which meant she was 16 when she had the baby, you know, and he was much older. So they were number crunching.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So it was a statutory rape and then a burglary charge against another character that's kind of involved in the story.
Okay. And what was his connection with Adam? Do we know?
As far as we know, we don't know. But it's in the police reports that like he's arguing with man. Antoine's arguing with man in street in the truck. It just, I've always felt like it was Antoine yelling at Adam because it was the black truck and telling him to get lost. And that's basically why Adam took off and never told anybody what was going on. And we didn't know till Sunday. I mean, he called me and said, you know, Amanda never came home, but that didn't mean anything. Like, I don't know. The whole thing was weird. If I don't know if you've ever watched, but it was just, he was like, he called me and he was like, Amanda never came home tonight. And I'm like, okay. So I called her work and they said she worked that day and she was there earlier. So like I called my mom and I called and I'm like, I don't know. I wouldn't worry about it. I said, maybe she's, you know, maybe she went to her girlfriend's or a friend's house and she fell asleep. She was working earlier. So what kind of trouble could she have gotten in a couple hours, you know? And basically the next day, same thing. And I talked to friends of ours that saw her and I also talked and he said he saw her that morning. So I'm like, okay, she's really fine. He saw her that morning. Well, Sunday, Adam called me and he was like, I took her to get drugs and she never came back out. And I said, you what? And he's like, I took her to get drugs and she never came back out. I said, where? And he's like, on the, and then he said like on the east side. I said, no, you didn't. Like, have any dealers on the East Side. You're lying. And that, you know, it stemmed from there. And then I called my mom and she came here and she went over there and he had her purse. And that's basically where the story started, was from that day, from that point forward. And she went to Antoine's house that night. And that was basically where it all began.
Let me tell you what I think happened as far as a connection between, I don't think there really isn't a connection between Adam and Antoine. Now, and I will never do anything to purposefully upset Leslie, but this might be upsetting to Leslie a little bit here, but this is,
I want to hear it. You don't think it was a drug dealer of his, maybe?
I don't think so, because, see, what happened was Adam and Amanda, not too long before that, walked into a print magazine, like a newspaper in town, and they took out an adult services ad. Amanda did. And I don't have the papers right in front of me, but it was not like a few days or a week before all this happened. So that's getting back to the decisions that Amanda was making in order to not be sick and in order to try to bring her life together. She had at the very end, I think, decided I'll go ahead and I will take out this adult services ad. Right. So Antoine called and texted.
I apologize. I don't want to cut you off. Let me cut you off. Yeah, just real quick before you finish.
Yep.
So I found that ad back when she went missing, and I found it through Polly. Mm-hmm. The cops did not find that. I found the ad, and Polly said Amanda told him the deal was that Adam and Amanda were splitting, were splitting the profits. It was like a 50-50 thing. And that's when I found out about the whole, and that's how we found out that she was doing that.
Yeah. So the police never found this out. This was all investigations from Danielle and the family and friends. Right. But when you go back, let me say this. If you go onto my website, there are some documents that you can take a look at, but to protect Leslie, I have not published all the documents. Leslie took a giant leap of faith. She was the very first person to do this with me. She gave me access to everything, Sherilyn, everything, including the most disturbing stuff to her, like the autopsy photos and all that stuff, right?
Right.
So,
which I can't even imagine how hard that is.
So my promise to her is to protect her feelings on this, so I don't put everything out. But I have everything. I have studied everything. I have the phone records. Okay. Antoine started calling and texting that number.
Right.
I think that he was just like, I'm going to get lucky. Right. That's what I'm going to do.
He was calling in.
He was luring in the way he had done with Celeste. So I don't think that Adam was some kind of like mule of women for him. I just think that Adam was her ride and they were splitting the deal. In fact, she had an appointment across town shortly thereafter. So I think she was going there to get drugs. I think Antoine probably promised her those drugs. He probably didn't have them, but he probably promised those to her.
Right.
And then once she was in his clutches, man. There was no getting out of that. From the moment she walked in that door, that was the end.
I agree with Gavin, but I still think Antoine went outside. I agree with you. Yes. I do. I agree.
He did.
But I still think he went outside and told Adam to leave, and Adam listened.
No.
And he should have never. I mean,
as also, you would on the east side of Buffalo when this giant monster is telling you to
but you wouldn't leave your friend.
You could still call the cops and be like,
I'm not defending
157 Adam. Spring Street.
I'm not defending Adam at all.
Yeah, no. I know that you're not Abbott, Gavin, but yeah, we're saying I understand that it's like I totally agree that there probably wasn't the connection between the two, but it's like, why wouldn't you call the police? You know, like why do you call Danielle and say, oh, she never came home, and
I would think that was his way of feeling guilty. I think he felt guilty.
Yes,
and I think he was a coward, and that's what I always said. I think he's guilty of being a coward, and I still think he's guilty because Amanda trusted him to take her there and be, and he was the one putting her up to this too, whether it was his idea, her idea, but he was the driver, because I already told you, Adam started getting pissed like 2 weeks before that if I picked Amanda up or if I took her and we went and got stuff, because he was missing. I think that she was feeding his addiction too, like with the money that right. he was making off taking her for her runs or whatever the case may be. And I do really believe right. that, absolutely. But I still feel like,
well, and
it was still brand new.
Yes, it was brand new. I suspect yeah. that, and this is just a theory, but I suspect that Adam was charging her to sleep on his couch. But I think he was charging her in sexual favors. That's what I think. Well, and so Adam is not an innocent guy here. The reason he didn't call the police is because he's a criminal, right? And a coward. Yeah.
Yeah. And he did. And that's why when he called me Friday and said, Amanda didn't come home. Amanda called me Thursday and said she woke up and he was sniffing her dirty underwear. So I've told Gavin the story. Like, so I'm like, literally, why the hell would she want to go back there? She didn't even want to be there. Like, it was literally like she was trying to stay gone as much as possible. Like, she would come to my house. She would go, you know what I mean? She would sleep at her friend Polly's. She would sleep at girlfriend's house. She would babysit at her girlfriend's house, like babysit her kids. So like, she was trying not to go, that she didn't want that to be home. Right. But at the same time, and the day that she worked, that Friday when he picked her up and they went to Antoine's, that's a whole nother ballgame too. She was at work. They said that she got a phone call and she was like arguing on the phone, like bickering with whoever she was with on the phone, like saying she didn't want to go or something. And then I guess he picked her up. And from what the witnesses say at the bar, that said that like she, like her demeanor completely changed. Like she was like annoyed, like pissed off that like she had to go with him or something. I don't know if she didn't want to do this one or whatever the case may be, or maybe she just didn't want to, who knows?
I would assume no. It sounds like no. Maybe she, like maybe he was working the phone while she was at work and he's like, okay, we got to go here or whatever. And she's like, I don't want to go to that side of town. Absolutely not. And for whatever reason, he got upset. They got in an argument. And then of course she's never, ever going to think that that's what she's walking into. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she did like, I don't know. But yeah, so, and he picked her up from work and that was the last time anybody saw her, was at work a couple hours before, well, besides Antoine's house, but he picked her up from work, took her to Antoine's, and that was the last time she was seen or heard of until her body was found.
So to me, here's the question. This is the most important question. Who else was in the room inside that house when Amanda went inside? So when we look at DNA that was collected from Amanda's body, they compared it with a DNA sample from Adam Patterson. They compared it with a DNA sample from Antoine Garner. Their DNA was inside and on Amanda.
Yeah.
But the DNA of, I think, a total of seven? Is that what it is?
I didn't know that there was that many. I thought there was another male and another female.
Let me open this up while... because I've got the docs here. Let me.
I have a question while you're looking at that, Gavin, for Danielle. So, there was another independent autopsy done, right? And it was that one that was done after the initial one of saying, "Oh, this was an overdose," that kind of reaffirmed your guys' suspicions that this was not an overdose, this was murder. And that report said that she was strangled out in California, right? Am I correct?
Yeah. Well, we became really close with Dr. Comparini, and they even almost tried to arrest her and arrest our attorneys and tried to block us from getting all the files. It took years and years for my mom to get the files and picture, everything was with her. We still haven't found Amanda's organs. Her there's still organs missing. There's like her heart's missing, her parts of her throat, her tongue, like things that would help like prove and show things with what happened to her are still missing. And they don't know where they are.
We're still here. We're still there.
So check this out. Still missing. Check this out, Sherilyn. Check this out. So this case pisses Black me boils. Off so much.
Yeah, I know. Like, I'm like,
as they are interring Amanda at the funeral, a person who I will not name comes up to Leslie and says, you really should get a second autopsy. And he is a person of, like, the position he was in was she believed him. Okay, I'm going to do this, right? So what happens at autopsy, and I'm going to get a little graphic here, Danielle, I'm sorry, but is everything within the human body, all the organs are removed. We all know that, right? But when they're put back in so that the body can be sent to the funeral home and all that stuff, they're put inside a bag, like a red, you know, biohazard bag, and put in back inside the body and then stitched up. Okay. So
yeah.
Leslie goes through this whole process and gets the body shipped out to California to Dr. Comparini. And when they open the bag, there are organs missing. Like they, Buffalo withheld them. And then what was it? 3 years of arguing back and forth before, before Buffalo's like, okay, well, yeah, we do. Okay. Our bad. We do have them. No, we're not going to give them to you. And then more before they let Dr. Comparini come and look at the histological slides.
They had like, to be there with her. They wouldn't let them leave the premises.
Correct.
And she wasn't allowed to have a helper. They had over, what was it? Like thousands, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of slides. And she had to do all the work herself. She wasn't, you know how you usually have like extra doctors helping you and like, especially when you have a case of this stature and files of this nature. Yeah. And they wouldn't let, and mind you, like they wouldn't let her have any help. She had to do it all alone, every single thing alone. Like they just
By the way, Buffalo has fought against this. Okay. Back to the DNA, including Amanda's DNA, there were four men, three women, one of which was Amanda, and two unknown, but separate profiles. They just don't know what gender they were. So there are a total of nine people in the room, Amanda plus eight.
Wow.
That's what the DNA says.
Okay.
So that's the question that I have is who is in that room? Now I have pretty, and Danielle and
we ran Tom.
Tom was not there. Yeah.
Nope. And he said like he was there afterwards. I didn't want to go, I don't want to go this route because this is a completely different thing, but I back then had seen a psychic. We've seen many of them throughout the years. And she told me there was three men in the room. And yeah, I'm not going to go into details of what she said, but she told me lots of graphic things, but she told me there was three men in the room.
There would have been three men in the room.
Yeah. And she just told me
Adam Patterson, he was outside.
And that's what she told me. And she said, she told me Amanda promised that she was never going to do drugs again. Like this is, she wants you to know she like, it was awful. Like she had me like hysterical. I couldn't even believe the things she was telling me. And this was back 10 years ago now, but maybe even 11, 12 years ago, but it was crazy. The thing she was telling me and told me what she went on in that room. And, it was just, honestly, it was just really weird for her to be able to explain those types of things. And I don't know if you guys get into all that or believe that. And who knows? Sometimes I think I do too, but I think I don't think it's always
some are predators. No, yeah. Some of them are predators and they just take advantage of vulnerable. Yeah, I know you are, Gavin, for sure.
but the truth is there were three men in that room. There were two other women in that room. Well, the DNA of those women, that was Antoine's grandmother's home. So one of those females could have been Antoine's grandma, a hair on the carpet,
who knows?
That transferred down.
And it could have been, exactly. And it could have been a dirty bed. Like you never really know.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Exactly. But there were still more people there. There were still more people there.
And the question that Cheryl Lynn asked, I always say Cheryl Lynn because I have a friend named Cheryl Lynn, two words. I need to stop doing that. The question that Cheryl Lynn asked was, why did Antoine get away with this? And I believe it's because of one of the people that was in the room.
I do too.
Right.
I do too. I believe we've talked to many people over the years and I still think Shauna's story is the most plausible. I still think there's others that are telling the truth too, but that Amanda went down there, they were supposed to meet and there was multiple men there. I don't even want to quote it because I don't even know exactly which is which, but I still think Shauna's is pretty accurate because even the grandmother says that a man showed up to the house the next day asking for Amanda and she said, and that was Tank. and all those things. Do you know what I'm talking about, Gavin?
Yeah, yeah.
That whole scenario. And I still think it's true, whether I still believe it. And I still believe the whole Shauna said that the girl, the other girl that ended up getting murdered in the hotel room, I still believe that they're all connected. I really do.
Yeah,
it's the same it's a circle of drugs and women. And let's just put it that way. I apologize. I don't want to say too much or say too little, but no, it was just basically a lot of things going on at that point where women were involved and drugs. And at that house, at Antoine's house, they would have women come over, lots of drugs, lots of people that.
So this was known to happen there. So this, you know, like, so, okay, that's okay.
And then sometimes I think it was just, I don't know. I'm not, that's the thing.
That's the problem, right? And that's the problem with not doing a proper investigation and just writing this off when there is so much that is clearly there to give you those answers. This is torture.
When we run off with this stuff, like we'll believe this is absolutely it, but then someone else will come forward and be like, I was in jail with him and this and this and this happened and yada, yada, yada. And it all is generally the same concept, but it's still like, if someone was there, like, why wouldn't they just
say something?
And just like Sarah, the three-way call, like stuff like that. Why wouldn't people just come forward and why wouldn't the cops just make them explain the situation and what exactly happened? Make Antoine explain himself. Like, why do we just let him get away with this?
Exactly.
He said that he didn't know who she was. Then he went to, oh, I sold her drugs. Oh, then she was then she was a prostitute. Like he ran with the media and just like let him flip his story 14 times and that was just fine. And I don't know.
And then they're like, oh, that's okay. But then when a witness comes forward, all of a sudden that person's unreliable because of their lifestyle, but he's okay to change his story, 10 times. It's infuriating. So, we've got Amanda's Army, right? Like that website for anybody who's wanting to follow Amanda's case and like how things are going. I mean, it's 14 years now. To light some fires under everybody, and what can we do? How can we support? Who can we put pressure on right now to have this properly investigated? What are you being told?
I don't know what to say to that because I don't have an answer. Because I tell my mom every time there's something new or every time there's, someone helping us, I'm like, well, I hope this works. But I feel like every time we're just like shot, like after a year of work or 2 years of work, like it'll just be like, oh, we're definitely going to get them this time. And there's no way that they can, and then they're like, oh, like then we finally get to court and they're like, oh, but sorry, we're not going to hear your testimony or sorry, this ain't going to work. Oh, they take our lawyers. Our lawyers will quit right in the courtroom. Like, I don't even understand. We've had what, 8 lawyers now that like literally will do years of work. And then like, they just all of a sudden can't help us or family friend. One was a family friend for 20, 30 years of my mom and just said that he couldn't help us no more.
Wow.
Like handed this like, just insane stuff that you couldn't even imagine. So honestly,
let me tell you one of the things that I was, I don't want to overstate, but I was one of the parties involved, like working with Leslie and Danielle and a couple of other people in the background. We thought, you know what, if number one, okay, there's one major thing here. The official story is that Amanda overdosed. That is the thing. So we thought, okay, we're going to go after that. And we were led in the right direction by another person. I know he doesn't want to be named, but the credit should go to him. I wasn't smart enough to figure this out myself. But once that person gave me a little bit of a nugget of information, I was then able to chase it down. And within a couple of months, I was able to prove that there's no scientific way that Amanda overdosed the way they said she overdosed because the metabolites were not in her system. The metabolites that should be there are not there. So she did not overdose, right? And that got to the point where even the DA told the news, yeah, there's something wrong with the autopsy for sure. Like he said that on the news, right? So we're like, okay.
Yeah.
So now he's not doing anything about it. So now we need public pressure. So a production company kind of came out of the ether, as they tend to do with Leslie. I suggested, yeah, maybe we should work with this production company to maybe put some pressure, right? So we put some pressure. Well, the production company puts us in touch with a lawyer who is able to do the work pro bono to sue, kind of the way the Greenbergs are, to sue to try to force the medical examiner's office in Buffalo to change the manner of death from accident to homicide, right? But we get to court after the DA has said publicly, yeah, there's something wrong with the autopsy report for sure. We get to court and they don't even allow us. The judge shut it down, lost, stamp, next. It was infuriating. The system is broken up there. The system is broken. What they said happened to Amanda, we have proven did not happen to Amanda. It couldn't have happened to Amanda, right? And expert after expert after expert has said, yeah, they're right. It couldn't have happened that way, right? The DA then goes, yeah, there's something wrong with the autopsy, as in they're right. It couldn't have happened that way. Get to court. Sorry, you don't have standing. Goodbye.
Ridiculous. Like, ridiculous. And they even in the beginning, they started with a pending death certificate. Oh, wait, did it start at undetermined, then pending, then it went to accidental overdose? Like, they couldn't make up their minds what they were going to do with it. It just seemed fishy from day one. They knew.
Right.
And even when they came out in the beginning, like, when that whole month was a blur, like, they even came out in the beginning, and when they found her body, they said, I'm not going to say names because I don't even know what I can say or what I should say, but someone of authority came out and said it was like a flip of a switch. It was like they decided everybody was doing what they should be doing. They were taking pictures when they found her body and stuff. And then all of a sudden everybody was like, this was an overdose. Like, and he said it literally was like he was there and like it was like a flip of a switch. Everybody just changed their mind. It was like they decided
the autopsy.
No longer. Yeah, this is no longer a murder or a homicide. This is an overdose. And this is literally while they're taking their pictures and like treating it as a homicide or treating it as a homicide. It's a crime, period. Right. Like, whether what it is.
Which is what you should do.
No, I'll go ahead and say what Danielle doesn't want to say. At the autopsy, Dr. What's her bucket? What is her name? I'm blanking on her name right now. Dr.
Oh, yeah, I am too. I had it written down. I forgot those notes.
Oh, my God. I can't think of her name either. I'm thinking Kobolinsky, but it's not.
She's doing the autopsy. And the homicide investigators are in there the way they're supposed to be. They're witnessing the autopsy. They're asking questions of the doctor, techs, all that stuff. Somebody with political power walks in and goes, there's nothing to see here, makes the homicide detectives leave. This was not a homicide. This was an overdose, and kicks them out of the room. What was her name? Vertis. Diane Vertis.
Yes.
Vertez. Yes. Yes. You said it. I'm like trying to look it up. She, 2008, Erie County Medical Examiner.
She's something else to watch in interviews.
We even said to her back then, we were like, there was like bruises all over her body. I was with Amanda on a regular basis. Like even back then during those first like few weeks when everything was such a blur, we were like, it's obvious that this wasn't an overdose. Like, you know what I mean? And she was like, she had like big bruises on her arms and stuff. And she was like, and I don't even exactly remember, but she was like, but with people with that live her lifestyle. And I'm like, what? She walks into walls? I was with her the day before. Like she did not that you can't have a bump or a bruise, but like.
There's one other dimension to this, and that is the marks on her face. So yeah, Sherilyn, when you look at the autopsy photos, Amanda is bruised and they're all like new. She's like beat, right?
And they even have a picture
on her neck.
And they have a picture of
her. Oh, so there is a bruise on her neck. Yeah. Right.
A handprint. And then you can see there's a picture that was obviously accidentally sent to us after those years of fighting in the pictures. Cause they only sent us like no pictures at first, and then it took the 3 years to get the rest of the pictures. And there's the medical technicians like standing back, and they're literally pointing at her neck, like showing. like pointing at her neck, like, look at this, like, look how awful this is. Wow. Like, what up? I know, yeah. I'm putting those words
and
in your mouth.
And then in the
but...
report, no, it's no. not, it's not in the report. Like, there's a photo of them going, holy crap, gosh. Look at all those bruises on her neck. And then nothing in the report.
Wow. But,
I mean, you know how the Elmquists, Sherilyn, will say, if our son really did commit suicide, we'll accept that.
Yeah.
I feel that same. I kind of came into Amanda's
case. Yes, I would love to think she did her
same
stuff
way.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Like, okay, let's see if she did overdose. And then it's just like time after time after time. Like, no, she did not overdose. No, she did not overdose. And they know she didn't overdose.
And that's the problem, is that it's that they know that. And even if it's this, I don't know what, I need to come up with a word for it, because it's this word of this like entitlement pride factor that these investigators and specialists, you know, the medical examiners have, where they cannot, some can do a really great job at admitting error. But then it's like others can't. And why is that? Is it because there's this corruption going on? Is it because they can't, you know, like because they were told to say this is how this all went down? Like, I don't understand how when you've got another, you know, examiner, another doctor, professional in your field saying she was strangled.
There was like, multiple doctors. There was ENTs. Right. Like there was toxicologists. There were so many doctors that said that like this doesn't add up. Like right. There was two. The one ENT said like there's no way that she could have survived the crushed hyoid bone. Like there was a lot of factors. Like so many doctors that came into it and said that like nope, like there's no way. And then even people like investigators, cops, like people that came forward knew that it wasn't that either. But it's like, I think the corruption is so high or whatever the case may be, or their boss or their boss's boss telling them like, nope, like this is what it is. Like,
yeah, I think you're right about that.
The cops the whole time said, we believe this is a homicide, but we have nothing to investigate without a death certificate that says there's a homicide. I'm like, which is absolutely ridiculous to begin with, because I mean, I understand, but at the same time, like if you know there's a crime committed, like it shouldn't matter what that death certificate says. Like,
exactly.
I don't know. Like, but I understand what they're saying. There's no crime to investigate if there's no crime. If there's nothing. You know what I mean?
I've talked to the couple of the investigators from the Buffalo PD, and the ones that I have spoken to have taken it seriously. They do believe Amanda was killed. But they still, the case won't go anywhere because there's power above them that won't let it go. So, and then even like, do you remember a little over a year ago, I would say the cop who was the one who found Amanda's body came up to your mom
at
the rally?
Yeah, I was there.
Like he was sincere, right? He was like,
he was
sincere.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'll never forget it. Like, cause I was standing there and when like he turned around and like, they like, and he like introduced himself, and even that day too, like when he introduced himself and they both looked at each other and they both knew, like they kind of like locked eyes and he was like, I am so-and-so. And she was like, who's like, I don't know who that is. You know what I mean? He was like, and then I think he explained who he was and his name. I don't know if his name changed Duffy. Or whatever the case may be, but the woman that was there that worked for Channel 2 was now working at City Hall. And she was like, she did the interview with Antoine back in 2009 and was like, literally my mom and her were like every day together, like going on interviews and like talking every day. And she even said that basically they offered her a job, but it was like, they kind of tried to hush her up because she was the one that was kinda talking for us. Like it was her voice. Yeah. It was her, you know what I mean? Like, and I think they do that with a lot of the people that are on our side, even our first attorney. Like he was literally at family birthday parties. And then all of a sudden he could no longer help our family. I don't know. I just feel like they know they know where to get in and how to stop people and like basically tell them like, we'll take, I don't know. I can't quote it, but you know what I'm talking about, Gavin. Like it's just, they've halted everything that should be of like, done,
open and shut. Let's close this. Let's get this changed and just have justice.
Yeah.
Danielle, thank you for giving us an hour and 15 minutes of your time.
Yes.
And I'm sorry if this is awful.
Awesome kiddos.
Yes. And I love it. I personally love it being a mom. And I think that a lot of people are going to relate to it because this is, you know, like this is your real life. This is literally what we want people to know and what we want to see. And this is how your everyday life is going. And you're a mama and you're still out here fighting for your sister, fighting for justice. So I think it's real.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Danielle. And I will talk to you soon. Bye, guys.
Bye, Danielle.
Right, take care.
Nice meeting you. Thank you.
Oh, that case is blood boiling. Okay, well, I feel terrible because I thought this is my bad too. I didn't go onto my computer to see, like, I can access playlists a lot easier. So I thought I was like done and good on like episode 5 or 6.
Don't even worry about that at all. Yeah.
I'm like, I can't wait to go back though and watch more, but my blood is going to boil. Like there, I was screaming at my phone. And when that medical examiner, oh my gosh, pretty much every time you had her come on the screen, I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
I was losing my shit.
Dude, the way I found out about this case was I was brand new looking at cases and I got I think it was a Facebook message or maybe a YouTube comment saying, hey, you should look into Amanda Winkowski. And so I started looking at it. I found the Justice for Amanda stuff. And then I reached out through Facebook Messenger and it just so happened that Leslie was feeling good that day. People reach out to her all the time, every day. It's, you know, everybody wants to cover the story. That particular day, she had just done a rally and she was feeling energetic and decided to answer me. And we became pretty good friends. The kind of sad thing about, like, it kind of feels like I dropped the case, but what happened was we got involved with a production company and they were developing a streaming show that was going to be multiple episodes and they were going to feature Amanda's case. And we all signed contracts to work on this show. And when my contract came due, I just didn't feel like they were, well, what happened was they really wanted more out of me. They wanted exclusivity. They wanted a whole bunch of these different things. And I went, no, I don't want you to own me, especially if you're not paying me because I'm doing a lot of work for you.
Right.
And anyway.
Yeah.
Leslie is still under contract through March with them. So.
Okay.
Either something will happen and the show will go, which is kind of what I'm hoping. And they'll get a whole bunch of attention on the case. Or if the contract expires, then I'll hop back on the case and try to keep helping.
Right, that's fair.
The people at the production company are awesome people. They're like, they're great. I just, I guess I just lost faith in whether the show is going to be sold or not, and I didn't want to be held back from doing other things, so I didn't want to sign and.
Which is fair. And you and I had discussed that too, right? Because had you done that, you would have been very limited to all of the other amazing things that you're doing right now. Ellen Greenberg, right. Elmquist.
So I'm hoping that they knock the ball out of the park and there's like a documentary series on Netflix or something about Amanda Winkowski. But if there isn't, if that doesn't end up happening, then I'm hopping back on that case.
Oh gosh, that would be amazing. Either way, you know, it's so infuriating. And I think that's a really good thing to touch on for anybody listening right now as being like, okay, well, like, what can we do? And it's like, at this point, in terms of like going to higher ups or whatever, like, it's been exhausted. At this point, we call it hit the masses, get people mad because that is how things change.
Yeah.
This is the world we live in right now.
In Amanda's case, I think the only thing that might, because here's the thing, the police can investigate even though the death certificate says accident. They can. They just never do. And they don't because when you get to court, the defense is going to say, hey, why, there's no crime here. The medical examiner says there's no crime here. right? And automatically there's reasonable doubt. So they never finish investigating. They never, continue to, or they never prosecute. So I think what would, I mean, they still need to, I'm sorry. There's something.
I love when these thoughts come to you. I like changed my stance. I was like, what's up, Kevin?
There is something that needs to be done. I was going to say the only thing that needs to happen right now is the DA. There needs to be a new DA.
Right.
But there's something else that we could all do. Okay. I was searching through. I was searching through the, actually, I shouldn't take credit for this. It was another person, again, brought to my attention a photograph of Amanda in the second autopsy, a picture of her face. And on her face, there are two bruises that are like, they're like this on her face. And you can't, I couldn't see them on the first autopsy. Right. So I go back to the first autopsy and I zoom in really close and they are there. It's just that over the time difference between when the first autopsy happened and the second autopsy happened, they became more visible. Right. But they are there in the first autopsy. And Sherilyn, the person who noticed them said, to me, that looks like a stun gun mark.
I was just going to say like a taser, like a, yeah. Like what?
Correct.
What is that?
So okay. I like did a very non-forensic thing. I went to Amazon and I found a picture of a stun gun, like the most common one, the one that was their like their recommendation. Then I got the
I'm so sorry. You can get this on Amazon?
You can get a stun gun on it. It's not the kind that shoots. It's like a handheld.
Can you imagine if somebody went through your Google history?
Right. Oh, it's ugly. It's ugly. No, no, no.
I know.
I sometimes tell my wife, so I'm investigating this crime and it has horrific information about what his searches are on his computer. So if I die and you come and see my computer, that is not me searching, okay? that is me investigating that guy. Anyway, so you know those handheld ones that you see on movies where they like poke somebody in the neck, go right?
Yeah.
It's that kind. Okay. So you can get them on Amazon, and I go and I take a look at the most popular one. I then get the product dimensions. I then measure the points between the two tips. All like in Photoshop and stuff. And then I compare it to Amanda's because they have a little measure tape on the picture, right? So I'm able to get the distance they are. And it was accurate within 0.02 millimeters.
Wow.
It was like bang. So I believe that she was hit with a stun gun. So if you can prove that she was hit with a stun gun, then the whole idea that she overdosed just completely goes out the window. I mean, it does anyway because of the toxicology. So what the family would like to do is to raise money to exhume her a second time and do a second autopsy. I spoke with...
Oh my gosh. And how painful is that even? Like that we're here now. 14
years
Sorry,
later.
But
Yeah.
Second time that they've had to make this decision.
Yes. And when I talked to Leslie about it, so what I did is when I figured that out, I called Kenny, my pathologist buddy, and I was like, hey, could you tell if that was a stun gun? He said, histologically, yeah, we would be able to tell that. And he gave me an entire explanation as to what happens on a cellular level when there's an electrical event. So he's like, it's really going to boil down to how good is the vault that she's in? Because then none of them are watertight. How good is the casket? What is the condition of her body? Yes, you should exhume her. Yes, you should have that looked at. And this is what they would be looking for. So we think that's about a $10,000 bill to get that done. The cemetery has offered for free to do the exhumation. Because they believe in Leslie. They love Leslie and they believe that Amanda was
murdered.
So they on their dime will exhume her, and then when the exhumation happens, the vault has to be replaced again. They already paid for a second vault. So they'll have to do that again, which they will do. They've volunteered to do. So what we need to do is then find a lab that will do the work. And we think that's about, you know, transportation and the lab work, the autopsy, the lab work, and then the reinterment and everything. All that's going to be about 10 grand. So,
okay. So this is what we can call to action.
So the best place to go is actually to my website, gavinfish.com. Okay. Click on cases, click on Amanda. I will reactivate the Amanda's Army link there. And because it had been deactivated, but I'll reactivate it. And that's what people should do. The Amanda's Army link, basically what you're doing is you're signing up to receive an email at the time that Leslie says, okay, we need to start raising money. So we're not asking anybody for money right now. Just join Amanda's Army and say, yes, I will look out for an email from Leslie when it's time to go. And then we will need people's dollars. Oh, and I love that.
Yeah. Right. Which I think is really, really, you know, just says something in itself that they're taking their time, like making sure it's serious. Like, we're ready to go. We're not just like reaching out like to be like, join now, give now. We don't really know what we're going to do. We don't have I think that's really important for people to have that transparency and know what they're helping for, when this is happening, what steps they are. And it makes people feel really involved and, you know, like that they're doing something to help, and that transparency is really important. So that's really cool that the family is willing to kind of invite everybody in on this really painful journey.
It's an infuriating one. And it was one that I kind of got my heart really set on, because after Leslie gave me access to everything, she then was like, hey, we have a bunch of old computers that might have other stuff on them, but we don't know how to get it. So I went up to Buffalo and I retrieved a bunch of their old computers and then just methodically went through everything. And I found old family photos. I found old videos. I found all this stuff. So I always go back to that whole paternal thing, especially when it's young women. They always remind me of my daughters. So I feel that same way towards Amanda. This is somebody who's been marginalized by everybody that matters, right? The police, the political establishment, they all marginalized her because she was an addict and because she was, she had started, as a sex worker in the couple of weeks prior to her death to feed that addiction. And nobody's been able to see past that. Every article that you read about Amanda Minkowski, the young prostitute or the young drug addict, they like lead with that every single time. Makes people turn off their hearts. Which is
so wrong, first of all. It does. And it's, and it shouldn't. And that's what like I said at the beginning of this episode, is that we need to get to a point in our lives as a society, like with empathy and compassion of when you hear that term, like, oh, well, she was a sex worker. Oh, well, she was an addict. Your initial response is so what else was she like? Where did she go to school? How many siblings does she have? Does she have kids? Is she a daughter? Yeah. Like, I don't really care, you know, what her profession is. Do I, you know, like, do we go into other articles or whatever and be like, air everybody else's laundry just because they were a lawyer and they don't deserve to have that discretion?
Exactly. You know, there is a, in my file, there is a letter from one of Amanda's teachers. So this is one of Amanda's teachers. She just wrote a short letter. Amanda Minkowski was an amazing young woman who doesn't remotely resemble the woman portrayed in the media over the last few years. Amanda was my student at Niagara Academy. She graduated in 2006 with a Regents diploma. She was an excellent student with an exceptional person. No matter what personal traits or trials Amanda was facing, she always made the effort to be in school and produce quality academic work. She was intelligent and hardworking, but she was so much more than that. here at Academy, we tell the story that Amanda was the only attractive girl to ever come into program who didn't have issues with other girls. The other girls couldn't be jealous of or angry with Amanda because she was just too nice. She won over the group immediately, simply by being herself, friendly, kind, and caring. She talked to everyone. She listened to everyone. She cared about everyone. This is Amanda Winkowski. Oh my
God, I love that. This is Amanda Winkowski, everybody.
That's Amanda. Amanda was a remarkable girl from a family who loved her. And her mom, Leslie, who we'll probably have on one of these days, her mom is, she says she has 12 kids. What she has are 8 kids and 4 kids from the neighborhood who she helped raise, who she feels are her children. So she had, and she's that kind of person, right? She saw a person, if she saw some family in the neighborhood that was having issues, or a friend of one of her daughters, one of her sons that was having issues, that was the safe landing spot, was at Leslie's house. And that's the kind of person she is, the kind of family she is. And what kind of makes her that person that will care for other people is the same thing that's driving that she cares about her daughter, Amanda, right? She's just a bulldog. Right. She will always fight. Yeah. It's a remarkable family. Really good people.
I'd love to talk to her. She sounds badass.
Yeah. To the bone. Bad to the bone. She's amazing. So glad we had Danielle on.
I'm so glad. That was lovely to hear from her. And like you said too, I got the same feeling that when you first talked about Danielle and Amanda to me and brought their story up and asked, you know, if we should have her on, and the way you explained it is almost like looking into what Amanda could have become, right? And what she was robbed of, of having the little nuggets who are sitting on the screen, you know, their little eye poking into the corner and playing and hearing those laughs and how that was taken from her. And she never got that opportunity to change, to make a change of a portion of her life, because I do want to keep reiterating, this was not who Amanda was.
She was trying to avoid the sickness.
Yep.
And like, that's something that I don't understand. I can't empathize with it because I've never experienced it, but Danielle explained
it
beautifully.
She explained it perfectly. Yeah. And I do want to mention, in terms of like me, you know, bringing up like what we do, like when we're trying to like feel better, you know, like we all don't like the feeling of discomfort, whether, you know, like we've hurt ourselves or we're sick or whatever. So we're looking for ways to like, to help that, amplify that by like, you're literally thinking that you're going to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think that any of us have ever been there unless we've physically been there. We almost died because we were almost dead from doing something for whatever, yeah, or we've been in addiction. And unless you have been there, you don't know. So it's like taking the most uncomfortable you've ever been in your life and living that day to day and trying to figure out how you can just not feel that.
Yeah. And she was about to start at a Suboxone clinic. She was about to start college. And the very first time I talked with Danielle, she shared the story of how she decided to get clean. And like they all decide to get clean, but it's way easier said than done, right? But how she got clean was because of children, her children, right?
Right.
There would have been something in Amanda's life that got, if she hadn't been successful with the Suboxone clinic and going to school and moving in with her sister, Carol Lee, who really loved her, cared for her, if that hadn't worked, something else would have. It would have been like Danielle. Yeah. There would have been something that worked.
Yeah.
And she would have gone back to being Amanda, right? She would have.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's dang it.
It's heartbreaking. And then and then what's more heartbreaking is that's because of this portion of her life, it's who she's defined as now, when media wants to talk about it, or, you know, like, or the medical examiner, and it's, and she's, you, like you said, re-victimized
over and over again. Every time somebody says the addict and prostitute who blah, 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 blah. Every time somebody says something like that or writes it, it happens all over again. And Leslie hears that. And Danielle hears that.
Exactly. Hears that. Exactly. All of them hear it. Yeah. It's, we need some changes.
Yeah. And we need to change, like, because I even find myself, I still find myself like these, this is, I've been through this experience with Amanda's family. The very first time in my life that I've known a family that's been affected by addiction. I mean, well, like Danielle said, they're probably all around me, but this was the first time that, like, there it is, and I'm facing it head on, right? And
right.
Even with all of that experience, 2 years of that, hanging out with the Winkowskis, it's a little bit more, because it was November that I reached out to her 2 years ago. Like, I interviewed a guy here in my town who is in and out of the county jail all the time, and it all has to do with crimes that he commits because he's a heroin addict. So he's trying to not use, but he's using, and he's, you know, committing crime after crime after crime. In those conversations, I catch myself in the back of my mind going, you idiot, why do you keep doing this? Right? Like the judgment is still inside me. It's still there. The bias is still inside me. Even knowing the Winkowskis, it's still inside me. So it's hard to, I mean, we do need to do something societally where we can overcome that somehow.
But I think that's really cool and huge of you to even admit that and say that, because it allows somebody else who is exactly in that same boat as you to be like, oh, okay. Like, it is okay to maybe like think this way right now and recognize that I need to open up my mind, my heart, my understanding of it, you know, because it's hard to understand things that we don't understand, haven't been through personally, right? It's like putting yourself in there and constantly checking that and reminding yourself like, okay, like you're recognizing that's a judgmental side that needs to change, right?
That's the only way you can change is if you recognize it first, I guess.
And that's huge. That is so huge. It's not going to happen overnight. Like, these things take time. It takes that constant self-evaluation of being like, oh, I'm kind of being a little judgy right now. And I'm judgy in other areas of my life, I think, you know, like in other things that I haven't experienced. This particularly, it's just because it's been around me for half of my life, right?
Yeah. Danielle once told me how it all started with them, and it was
okay.
She was able to narrow it down to one party. There was one party, and she tried a pill.
Wow.
And then Amanda tried a pill too. And I think it was,
I think that's really, really powerful, because that is, it's usually how it goes. You don't go into something being like, oh, I'm just going to be full blown committed into this. You know, like she said, she's like, oh, you know, maybe I'll try this. Maybe I'm going to drink and smoke and okay, I'll try the one pill, but I'm not going to do this. And you've got that threshold, but you keep crossing it. You keep pushing those boundaries, and it's always the one time.
Yeah. And that police chief the other night, he brought up something to me that I had never thought about before, because I brought this up. I think the way I said it to him is like, I understand why addicts continue to use. What I don't understand is why they start in the first place. And he goes, oh, people lie to them. I was like, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, they say this is only addictive if you inject it, or it's only addictive if you snort it. But if you eat it, you know, if you just take a pill, then you're fine. So they've been lied to. And you might say, well, why are they so naive to, you know, fall for that? But most of them are kids, man. Most of the time they're kids. So it's that one time.
Yeah. You don't really have a lot of situations where, you know, somebody's just walking into a party at 55 years old and being like, I got to try this. Right. Like it's situational. It's, experimenting, it's pushing that rebellion, and not in every case, but I, you know, in often ones that I've heard, it that is kind of how it starts. Or, you know, like they've been, a lot of it is a trust factor too into like other people, like you're saying, like it's like, oh, or yeah, it's not addicting, or just have one or whatever, it's not going to do anything to you, just one time.
And it's even more dangerous now. I mean, sorry to keep going back, but that conversation with that police chief, he was telling me about, they find presses all the time. And I was like, what are presses? He's like, pill presses. So they will put extremely dangerous pills into innocuous looking little things. So a kid might think that they're taking something they shouldn't take anyway, but maybe like a Xanax or something like that, but it ends up being,
oh, and it's got fentanyl in it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've had those conversations with my kids and like, I can't believe I have to have this conversation, but I feel like I have to. It was just a couple weeks ago. I sat down with our oldest daughter and her boyfriend, and then our next two oldest came in, and I was like, hey, listen, guys, I don't think that you would ever purposefully go out and just do drugs. I just don't think that you're that way. But if you ever are tempted, let me tell you what is happening right now. Because that's been on the news like for the last year. I read a book. What was the name of that book? Oh, I can't remember the name of the book. I'll think of it. But described the whole chain of where the chemicals come from. Chemicals are manufactured in China. They're shipped to Mexico. And now cartels they don't even need like hide in the jungle. They're in warehouses and office complexes, having these labs building designer drugs exactly the way they want to design them. And they turn them into pills that look fun. Stuff like that, like, but you don't know what's in it. Please never experiment. Please stay safe.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah. Oh, and then it can be anywhere. I mean, like Canada too, right now, like it's huge, huge issues with fentanyl, like in what, you know, quote unquote, would be like a mundane drug, and kids are trying it, or they already have, you know, regularly used it and their body is fine with it. And they do the same dose and all of a sudden they're dead because, it wasn't what was actually in there. I've had the same conversation with my 16-year-old daughter. It's hard, but I mean, if you're not having those conversations, you're really doing a disservice in pretending that this stuff isn't going on and that they're not exposed to it. No matter what neighborhood you're in, no matter what upbringing you are, this is everywhere. Yeah. And I think that that's important to have and make people aware of and listen to these types of things, because this is exactly what it can lead to, no matter who you are, what upbringing you have.
You know, and Leslie, like, she told me one time, she's like, the drugs were never part of my life. I was completely surprised when my children, it's not just her child, her children were caught up in this epidemic of opioids in Buffalo at that time.
Yeah.
And
that was big at that time too, right? I think that's also important to recognize.
Yeah,
is that.
Yeah, it waved through. It was like just washed through Buffalo, all the kids.
Right.
And she ended up mortgaging her house because the Suboxone clinic wasn't covered by any type of insurance or anything like that. So she ended up losing a house trying to make Amanda and Danielle well. And if you talk to her, she says, and I'll do it again and again and again until it works.
Yes. Mama. You know? Yeah. Oh, heartbreaking. Yeah. Well, I think, I'm so thankful for you to get Danielle on here to allow people to kind of see that side. And now I know for sure we're going to have a lot more people in the army listening.
Yeah, so just go to GavinFish.com.
We're waiting for our call out.
Yeah, if we could build that list. I think that list has about 400 people now. If we could get 5,000 people in there, and when the time comes, everybody gave a couple bucks, that would get it done.
Oh my
and
gosh.
I feel really confident that we could prove that she was stunned with an electrical device, hoping that her body is in a good enough condition to test it.
Okay, that's what we're doing. That's what we do. Love ya. See you next time.
I love you too. I think you're terrific.